Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Okay, first thing we got to do is sort out, I just need to make sure, is it 1 minute past the hour? I know that's a silly thing, especially for a regularly scheduled live broadcast to be asking, but weird things happen here, man. Weird things. Now, we've got a clock on the wall that syncs itself to the atomic clock in Fort God knows where. And it's supposed to be as regular as the sunset and the sunrise and the tides and all of that other stuff. But it's telling me that right now here on the East Coast, here on the, well, not on the East Coast, but in the mountains of the Eastern time zone, that it's 11 minutes, no, right now it's 12 minutes past 6 p.m. Every other clock in the house says it's just 2 minutes past 6. And I'm afraid I don't want to go through a time warp. Not on this Friday. Please? Yeah, okay. Thank you. Thank you, Lottie. So the clock is sick and not me. Much better. I feel much better about that. How does a self-setting, self-regulating atomic clock go 10 minutes fast? But okay, we're going to be all right. It's going to be okay. It's not a time warp. No strange H.G. Wells creatures are going to come blowing through the door or anything. Yeah, I don't know. The isotopes must be taking the day off at some point. Who knows? But, hey, it's Friday on the front porch on the horn. And it's a beautiful Friday here in what's left of almost level West Virginia. It doesn't even have a button to sync it, Lottie. It does it itself. That's why I bought it that way. Maybe it's the batteries. How could batteries make a clock run fast? That makes no sense. Oh, well. But anyway, it's Friday on the front porch here in what's left of beautiful, almost level West by God, Virginia. And so we're going to catch up this evening on some stories maybe that didn't get the attention they deserved during the week, as well as some new stuff, some bizarre stuff, some fun stuff maybe. And along the way, well, I'll go ahead and let you know. Here's where we stand. After the early part of the week, fundraising just more or less with exception of a very few kind people, dried up, and we need to catch up this evening in a big way, because we are badly behind, and the bills are piling up again, because we had a hard time getting May taken care of. But anyway, so tonight the goal is to catch up from Wednesday, Thursday, and tonight, so tonight's goal is around $300. I'm happy to report that we are $50 along the way, and thank you very kindly for making that happen. So basically now we only need 25 folks to pony up $10 a piece, and we'll come even with the week, which would be helpful. So there's that. PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com, as is the snail mail address. You know, why is this important? Well, you know, I've been telling you for a while now about the AIC Act. The AIC Act is going to drop next week, and I need to be there for it. Others have worked much harder than I, but I have been a part of this process, and I want to be there to witness this moment of Appalachian human rights history. I am told I am needed to be there. So I'm off to Washington, D.C. next week, and then immediately following that, I have to go to a meeting with a group with whom Cold River Mountain Watch is involved, which will keep me on the road for quite some time, up to and including something around probably the 27th or 28th of June. I spoke to Ben Birch last night. Ben will be running the rerun stream during the course of that time, and I'll get back as soon as I can. But it's another long road trip, and I've got to pay bills before we leave. You know, things like the interweb tubes and phones and so forth. So there's that. But I hate being away from the microphone. I hate being away from this. But again, I tell you simply, I can't just sit here and talk about it. This is our world. And this is the assault upon our world. And as a consequence, I will be away for this historic moment. I'm proud to say that we have a number of co-sponsors on the bill, and I'm very proud and thrilled with the efforts you all have made. You have begun making a difference, a very, very big difference, I might add. So you will, when it happens, you will see the co-sponsors on it, and you will know the impact you have had and that you will continue to have, because we will, even after the thing is launched, we will continue to knock on doors and try to raise further awareness of exactly what is going on here in the Appalachian Sacrifice Zone. So that's the housekeeping. A little reminder, starting on July the 2nd, we will be, for the third year in a row, bringing you the PRISM West Virginia Summer Academy, all-day-long broadcasting of absolutely mind-boggling, brilliant American history. And that'll be the 2nd and the 3rd, and the 5th and the 6th, and the 9th of July. All day, every day. I wouldn't miss it if I were you. I'm going to be there. I'm not going to miss it. Okay, so we all know that, we all know that getting confirmation. Yes, the time is what it is. Kate on the Front Range noting, magnetic pole shift, polar shift, magnetic north shift, several degrees every once in a while. Welcome to the magic world. That's why I bought the clock. It's not supposed to be subject to magic. Dadgummit. No, there is a lot of fascinating stuff out there this evening, and some of it's just mean and stupid and hateful. And we will get to every last little bit of it, I hope, because I won't have a chance to, I don't think I will have a chance to do this again until we get back because of the loss of certain pieces of equipment that, you know, happened when the little Belgian bastard, the LBB, relieved me of my backpack. But I'd prefer to start the program with a couple of pieces of mail. Two good, one bad. Let's start with the good. You know, we're, what, 6-7 hours behind Europe. So there's usually a little bit of a lag in me and you, therefore, hearing from our buddy Scott in Sweden. But apparently we darn near bridged that time gap, too. Hey, Bob or Rebob? Apparently, yes, the previous note that was, hey, Bob or Reboob, was merely a stuttered O and not a renaming. So, hey, Bob or Rebob, says Scott. What in the F was that audio clip you played where some TV anchor did not want to read the headlines and asked some male chauvinist to do it instead? Well, in answer to that question, that was, see, Scott notably did not say news clip or news network because it wasn't. It was from Fox News, which is merely a brand name. They're strictly entertainment. They've admitted it in court. That was Fox News, and that was Gretchen Carlson getting upset at Brian Kilmeade, and I guess by extension Steve Ducey, who was doing the Willard Scott part of the thing out on the street somewhere. But it was Brian Kilmeade, we're letting women in everywhere. We're letting them play golf. They're playing tennis. They're everywhere. At which point Gretchen Carlson got up and walked off the set and said, do the headlines yourself. So that's what that was in answer to Scott's question. Is this really the current state of news reporting in the United States? Yeah, it kind of is. I mean, that was Fox, and granted, Fox is America's answer to Radio Rwanda, Scott. But you're not going to find just a hell of a lot different if you tune in over in the mornings to, and it was a morning news program, you're not going to find a hell of a lot different if you tune in over to, say, ABC, CBS, NBC, MSNBC, oh, Jesus, not MSNBC. Then you get Joe. I finally took the Horn family's advice and quit watching, and I've been feeling much better lately, thank you. But yes, that is the state. Scott notes, for decades, U.S. news has been too cutesy by an order of magnitude or two, and clips like this one make me very glad this is radio and not TV. Because the audio impression I get is one of uncontainable egos primping and emoting primarily for self-titillation. Yes, and in the case of Fox, for the titillation of their 80-year-old median demographic. I am reminded, continues Scott, of diverse corrupt early Roman emperors staging theater pieces, starring themselves in order to keep their dopamine levels primed. St. John's wort evidently not yet discovered. Or sufficiently strong hybrids not yet developed. Pretty spot on, Scott. And he says, I know you cannot understand much. You just said a mouthful, brother. But do check out Swedish TV's news for the tone of voice used and the body language and tell me what you think. 5 minutes ought to be more than enough. And he sent me a link and I went and I watched some real live, honest to God Swedish TV news. And you don't have to, he's right, you don't have to speak the language in order to tell that there is a manifest difference between what passes for news in the civilized world and what we get here. He's right, the body language was different, the tone of voice was different, the presentation was different. The news anchor, who was female but not blonde and not leggy, I don't even think they showed her from the waist down, would never be able to get a job on Fox without a dye job and reconstructive plastic surgery. I'm not saying that to be mean. I'm saying that to be realistic. This, by the way, is the Horn. Head on radio. Network.com. I'm Bob Kincaid. She couldn't work here. Because news is not about news. And especially not morning news in America. It's morning news in America. Well, Nancy. Because you see, the for-profit media understand that when America first wakes up, it probably is just getting around to getting its first dose of serotonin reuptake inhibitors via a variety of patent medicine, big pharma, so-called antidepressants. America, to a shocking degree now, has to be thoroughly medicated before it ever gets out the door in order to cope with the day and not just head up the nearest bell tower with a clown suit and a rifle. which all happens altogether too often anyway. So the news has to be presented chirpy and smiley with lots of happy talk. And Brian Kilmeade saying, oh, we're letting women do everything these days. And then when Gretchen Carlson storms off the set saying, oh, she needed a shower. You know, as if, I don't know, her hormones were running rampant. But of course, last night we also covered the ground of how decorum was utterly destroyed in the Michigan House of Representatives when a member of that body said vagina and another said vasectomy, and the letter V was stricken from the list of words that would be permitted in the Michigan Republican-controlled House of Representatives. And the women were told they would no longer be allowed to speak. But yes, that is the state of broadcast news. And as noted, it ain't much difference from anything going on any of the other programs. Scott went on to note that there is a big difference. He said very few Swedish presenters on SVT, our BBC, would get a job on commercial TV. We even have one guy with an immobile glass eye whose gaze is rather disturbing. But he's a damn good reporter. But you're right. It is actual journalism and highly professional. 3 years ago, one of our TV honest-to-God meteorologists decided to go all Al Gore and presented his very own Inconvenient Truth-style lecture, presents it all over the country. He's probably visited every junior high school, county council, city council, etc. in the country. And some folks probably several times. He is tireless. You know what that'd get you in America, Scott? That would get you suspended. Unless you were saying that global warming was entirely made up and not real. In which case, it'll just get you a job at Fox News. Just like saying that that Barack Obama and Joe Biden are turning teenagers gay will probably get that little weirdo from West Virginia a gig on Fox sooner rather than later. Dates away, well, beginning Monday and back around the 28th or 29th. Kevin. Kevin just sent an email saying, please repeat the date, she'll be gone. There will be reruns going during that entire time. I will be tweeting and Facebooking along the way just to let you know how things are developing. So that's mail, piece of mail number one. Now, piece of mail number two. I saved these for the beginning of the program. You remember our little right-wing lurker? Chadrick Rumpensteiner Bachman? Great name. I gotta give credit where credit's due. If you're gonna come up with a fake name to use because you're afraid to use your own, then that's a dandy. You know the news, right? Today, President Barack Obama took steps to allow certain people who were brought into this country to have a shot at the American dream. The right wing has been having a sure enough, no kidding, purple polka dotted, blue screaming, hissy, not to mention having kittens with crocheted tails all day long. Losing what passes for their minds. So consequently, I get from our little right wing lurker, I get this. So Obama is now desperate enough to finally let the flow if immigrants come in illegally? Again, so Obama is now desperate enough to finally let the flow if immigrants come in illegally? I'm going to assume that what he meant was, so Obama is now desperate enough to finally let the flow of immigrants come in legally? He continues, my wife is Filipino and a teacher. Her friends are Filipino teachers. Their spouses are not allowed to work or at least be on a payroll until, of course, the working spouse becomes a U.S. citizen. Can you explain this to me, please? Well, Chadwick, you're getting most of your news from the for-profit right-wing media, so I don't know if there's, I don't know if it's either physically, philosophically, morally, ethically, or even within the terms and conditions of an expanding universe possible to do that. I'm sure it's not just a Democrat thing, but why can't the spouses of working visa holders work? Why is the administration pushing to bring in more people who are illegal while there are spouses that could on the payrolls and pay taxes? You see, this is what happens when you pay attention to the right-wing filth machine. One of the principal architects and advisors and pals of the removed neo-Nazi senator in Arizona is a creepy pasty dude from Kansas by the name of Chris Kobach, and he serves as an immigration advisor to the Willard Romney campaign. He says that the president's plan is deeply troubling. Kobach, as Secretary of State of Kansas, somehow or another managed to be the person who actually wrote SB 1070 in Arizona, as well as the incredibly stupid, hateful immigration law in Alabama. You know, the one that got a Mercedes-Benz executive jailed for not having his papers in order. Chris Kobach has said he is going to openly defy the President of the United States because he says that the deferred action policy, as announced, is illegal. Now, you do understand, and I know you do because you're progressive, you're liberal. In other words, you've got a functioning brain and not thin gray settling sloshing in between your ears that pass for brains instead of actually being them. You understand that this is a partial accommodation for children. For children who, having been born, and whom the right wing would have cared about if they'd only stayed unborn, for children who, having been born, were brought to the United States without any real say in the matter. This is the generation of people that the Republicans despise. This is the generation of young people that the Republicans are hoping will grow up to be their little helots. You remember, that was the servant, slave, tormented class that the Spartans used to routinely beat, murder, and rob. Well, it is this young class that the Repiglicans and the white supremacists and the weirdos of the GOP and the teabaggers and whatnot hoped were going to grow up and scrub their toilets and mow their lawns for substandard wages. Not go to college. Not become perhaps authors or teachers or scientists or anything like that. No, 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 no. Because, you see, that's what this immigration initiative does, is it finally takes the sins of the father, so to speak, or mother, off of the backs of children who had no say-so in where they went, save for the fact that they had to go with mama and daddy. Or mama or daddy. lives up to the promise that is inscribed upon the tablet. No, that's the... No? Anyway, lives up to the promise that Emma Lazarus mentioned in saying, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Yeah, I know. The Republican Party doesn't want no more of them huddled masses unless they can be hired for $1.95 an hour and are willing to scrub toilets and keep their mouths shut. But Kris Kobach is a man of ethics and principle. He says that the president is illegal. Of course, Kris Kobach probably also thinks he's a Kenyan Muslim anti-colonialist with deep-seated tendencies of hatred toward white people. Why not? But here's the funny part. And I mean, this comes from a quarter I never thought I would be mentioning. Another individual gave an interview on the president's policy today. This isn't about just letting anybody willy-nilly into the United States, opening... What was it Chad said? Chadwick, what did you say? Oh, there. Finally, let the flow if immigrants come in illegally. Can you imagine that? He's saying that about children. He's saying that about toddlers. He's saying that about two-year-olds who grew up, obeyed the law, stayed out of trouble, lived the American dream, and would like to go on and keep on living it and do things like crazy stuff, like go to college, get good jobs, and pay taxes. Good luck to them, anybody that age trying to get a job these days. We could sort that out with some Social Security reform by making everybody pay FICA taxes on all of their wealth. We could sort that out. We could lower the retirement age so young people could enter the workforce. Wouldn't that be neat? Of course, the world's richest man, some Mexican fellow, announced in the last couple of days that he wants to see the retirement age raised because people are living longer. The only problem being that they aren't. That actual life expectancies are declining because ordinary folks are working harder and they're still working the same broke-down, back-breaking jobs that they have worked since time, well, since settled society began with the advent of agriculture and animal husbandry. But like I said, it was from a strange quarter that I heard this latest comment about President Obama's initiative dealing with the Dream Kids, because these are the people who would have been served by the Dream Act if only the Congress could get off its porcine hindquarters and get its front trotters out of the Citizens United trough and actually do something for the American people. But they can't, because the Republican Party doesn't want any part of that. This is the answer. I know, says the questioner, I know you were talking about the idea of calling it amnesty, and you were saying it isn't amnesty because... dot, dot, dot. And this is the answer given. They haven't done anything wrong. In order to get amnesty, you've got to have done something wrong. These young people are innocent. They haven't done anything wrong. To me, this is the low-lying fruit of immigration reform. This ought to be something we can all unite around. They have to have been under 16 when they got here. They got to be under 30. He's not granting citizenship. He's granting a pathway to legal status. He's making it so they're protected from being deported and they can get on with their lives and their education with serving in the military, investing in themselves, in our nation, and our nation's future. Who can be against that? Question. What's your reaction to people who call this amnesty? Answer. They need a course in remedial English. It's not amnesty. Question. Do you have any advice? Answer. Yeah. I would say to the Romney campaign, this is the right thing to do. You should applaud the president for doing the right thing and encourage Congress to follow up by codifying it into law. Guess what? None, precisely none of that is going to happen. Why? Because all the teabaggers, well, I guess we're going to have to go back down to the Rio Grande and start shooting them coming across, because ain't nobody wants to protect our borders. Now, here's the part where if you're standing up, you need to sit down. If you're sitting down, you need to make sure that you're not just going to tip right over. You know who said all this? And I mean, you could have knocked me over with a feather when I read it. They got a little thing going on in Washington, D.C. right now called the Faith and Freedom Conference. Attending that conference is a man named Dick Land. Dick Land is a former exalted noble grand noble dragon or the precious lumpkin or whatever of the Southern Baptist Church. You heard me right. The Southern Baptist Church. Hardline, right-wing, anti-everything, hates the gay folks, virulently opposed to letting a couple of guys or a couple of women pick out China patterns and monogrammed towel colors, those little soaps that sit on the dish and you're never supposed to touch. That Dick Land. And so, in light of the fact that Chadwick here seems to be pushing the typical right-wing point of amnesty, I can only say that one of the most hardline, hate-filled, right-wing religion industry spokespeople in this country says, and this is a quote, "They need a course in remedial English. It's not amnesty." Who also said, "These young people are innocent. They haven't done anything wrong. They haven't done anything wrong. In order to get amnesty, you've got to have done something wrong. And they haven't." But don't look for Willard Romney to get this right. What Willard Romney will do, on the other hand, is get this right wing. Going back to Scott's earlier email, Jim notes, with a beautiful reference. Like the Stygian witches who had to share an eye, that trio of idiots on Fox Morning have to share a poorly developed brain. So poorly developed that I think, Jim, we are hard-pressed to refer to it as a brain as such. Marty with a query, does that mean that those moronic teabaggers are going to shoot Americans who might be trying to escape to Mexico and further south, are they? Well, they just want to shoot somebody. The hell good's having a shooting gun if you ain't shooting the gun. Kevin noting, let's call this conference, this Faith and Freedom Conference, what it is. It's not Faith and Freedom, it's the Mind Control and Fascism Conference. All too true. Jim gets the first toaster of this Friday on the front porch, awarded by Dr. John for Stygian Witches. If I was on broadcast air, I wouldn't go near Stygian. I would not go near the phrase Stygian Witches for a farm. You say that two or three times, and you're just begging for one of them $475,000 nipple flash penalties from the FCC. A query from an individual who may remain anonymous, because the writer said not necessarily for broadcast, but I think it is. With regard to my reading these emails from our right winger, you know, we've only had one. I mean, I had a bunch of them back on in the bad old days of broadcast terrestrial radio in America's fifth smallest radio market. But they dried up and went away as soon as they figured out that I no longer had any tolerance for them. This query, why give this gleefully uninformed douche airtime? They have, as you say, 1,000 times our space. He's too lame to make it into Limbaugh, Bortz, Ingram, Hewitt, etc. Way too weak for the horn. True, in all cases. Not necessarily. I don't necessarily agree. I think he would probably be a natural fit for Limbaugh, Bortz, Ingram, Hewitt, Hannity, Rusty, Humphreys, whoever the rest of the weirdos are. But there's some sort of jolly pleasure, I suppose. Marty noting, and our right-wing lurker is no doubt a Christian. Don't know. So there's that. And that's the reason. It was just perfectly timed. I might have let this thing lay were it not for the fact that Dickland, not Bob, Dickland, said he needs a course in... Huh? What? I'll get back to it. Yeah. Remedial English. You know, the language that the right-wingers are constantly saying needs to be the national language, even though a vast majority of people attempting to speak it, most of whom are teabaggers, right-wingers, John Birchers, skinheads, and the like, probably couldn't pass the immigration proficiency test in English. No, there's that sense of persecution that pervades the religion industry here in the United States is, as with, it seems, all bad things that we come up with, spreading. The story here about an individual by the name of Dr. Richard Scott. I actually received this story via an emergency blast email from the right reverend, upstanding, Jesus, God-fearing Donald Wildman of the American Family Association of Tupelo, Mississippi, a proven hate group. This thing is not datelined. Let me see if I can... get some idea of where they are. I'm guessing the UK. Yep, UK. I think they're on Rumpole of the Bailey Street in London, it says here. It is the story of a man by the name of Dr. Richard Scott, who is quite certain he is being persecuted for his Lord. Now, Dr. Richard Scott is not one of those doctors that can't put on a Band-Aid without killing somebody. No, he's a general practitioner. He's a physician. Went to medical school and everything. according to what I'm looking at, has practiced for over 28 years. And he's been investigated by GMC. I had no idea that the General Motors Corporation had oversight of physicians in the UK, but, oh wait, no. The General Medical Council of the United Kingdom has something called an investigation committee. And yesterday it issued a formal reprimand of Dr. Richard Scott. Why? Let's review. Dr. Scott is a real-life, honest-to-goodness, no-kidding physician. Dr. Scott sees patients as a general practitioner. He sends patients on to other people, other practitioners who might be more specialized when they need specialized care. He is a physician. He is not the Reverend Dr. Scott. He is not Monsignor Dr. Scott. He's not Pope Dr. Scott. He's just Dr. Scott, and he happens to be, he says, a Christian. So a patient comes to Dr. Scott, and if one, and it's, you know, it's one of these little statistical moments, kind of like drunk driving. They say that when somebody gets busted for DUI, that odds are they've been doing it for a while and their luck finally ran out, and they were lucky enough just to get caught and not killed. So if this has happened once, it's probably happened hundreds of times. But nobody said anything about it until now. Dr. Scott was seeing a patient, and in his own words, Dr. Scott says, "I can't get it gone, Captain. The dilithium crystals are all burned up." No, Dr. Scott didn't say that. That's just our obligatory Star Trek reference for the evening. He said, "I'm deeply upset at this decision by my professional body. My professional reputation has been compromised, and I have been disciplined just for sharing my Christian views. Yet it is recognized by many peer-reviewed articles that faith can help unwell people." Dr. Orwell? George? All right, Mr. Orwell. You want to take a look at that last clause of that sentence? Faith can help unwell people. Oh, Bob. That's remarkably, remarkably delightful. I thought so. Faith can help unwell people. And it does, every day. Children, all the way up. You take a perfectly normal, healthy child, and you give them a big dose of fundamentalist religion, and you unwell them. "I'm appalled by this decision," says Dr. Scott. "Many doctors will be deeply concerned with the way this case has been handled by the GMC. Our society seems to becoming more and more repressive, with ordinary decent people being reported to the authorities and disciplined not for committing any crime, but just for expressing their Christian beliefs. See, this guy's just like the rest of them. He's a liar. He was not disciplined simply for expressing his beliefs. He was disciplined because a patient came to him for medical treatment and instead of medically treating them, he told them to go pray. I'm afraid there's nothing much I can do for you here. I do, however, suggest you pray as I am a Christian. And when properly invoked, my God can be quite powerful." In testimony, the patient said he was offered no medical options, but that Dr. Scott did tell him that, quote, belief in Jesus Christ was the only way that his suffering would be relieved. And Dr. Scott thinks he's being persecuted. If he wants to be a priest, let him go be a priest. I don't know if he's married or not. There are certain, like, he can be an Anglican priest. They can be married. He can be a Greek Orthodox priest, a Russian Orthodox priest. They can be married. If he's unmarried, he can be a Roman Catholic priest. And then when people come to them and say, I don't have any medical options, he can say, let's pray over it. But if he wants to actually be a physician, he needs to keep his efforts within the realm of medicine. Is this so hard to comprehend? That's one of the themes that seems to be emerging over the course of the last few days, if not the last couple of weeks. The things that we take for granted, things that we think are seemingly innocuously comprehensible to just about anybody with a pair of neurons to rub together, prove to be insurmountable hurdles to right wings and fundies. They can't understand that sea level rise is not liberal code. They can't understand that science does not have a political bias unless the politics happen to be ex post facto aligned along the same lines as the science and based upon fact and reason. And now we find out that they can't understand that the practice of medicine is not a function of praying and laying on of hands, but of using the scientific method to diagnose a problem and deal with the patient as best as possible. And if, as occasionally, probably more occasionally than any physician would like to even think about, you run into somebody for whom there are no medical options, then fine. Say, I suggest you contact your priest, or your shaman, or your imam, or your lama, or whatever. But don't be mixing the two, because they aren't the same thing. And no, there aren't any goddamn peer-reviewed articles that say that prayer does anybody any material healing good. There aren't. He is, in short, a liar. And according to their book, there is a prince of lies, and apparently this creep is a servant of him. Simple, simple, simple things that they just can't wrap their minds around. Jeebus. And it goes on and on and on. It's kind of a piece of good news, I guess. A lawsuit has been filed in the state of Texas against the Liberty County Sheriff's Office, as well as media outlets KPRC, Belo Corp, The New York Times, CNN America, Thomson, Reuters, and ABC News. Why? Because a couple, Joe Bankson and Gina Charlton, were subjected to a hellish, horrific invasion of their personal privacy and their right to quiet enjoyment of their property. You know, one of those things the teabaggers say and the libertarians say and the repiglicans say they're all about, unless they're not. In the form of a huge descent of the said Liberty County Sheriff's Office onto their property to dig it up No, really. To dig it up. Searching for a mass grave. Bodies upon bodies upon bodies. This happened in rural Liberty County, Texas, back in 2011. Not a single body was ever found buried in the backyard. So what, you might ask, would possess the Liberty County Sheriff's Office to go out and dig up the yard? I mean, maybe it's kind of like the fact pattern in U.S. v. Leon, that Supreme Court case, where the DEA agents or whatever were supposed to go and knock down the door and find all the dope in apartment 3, but instead they went to apartment 2 and just wound up terrorizing an innocent family. And the Rehnquist court had to craft a good faith exception for law enforcement screw-ups out of it. Maybe that's what it was. No. They wouldn't have a lawsuit if that was the case, because there's a good faith exception to law enforcement screw-ups enshrined in the body of decisional evidence, decisional law, the stare decisis crafted over the course of centuries by the Supreme Court of the United States. No. Among other things, it was rental property that these people were occupying, and they couldn't go back to it because the mere presence of law enforcement there had made it pretty much impossible. Well, just because they didn't find the bodies don't mean they ain't there. There's a Jane Doe on the lawsuit, too, and she is why the whole ball of wax got rolling. This is the kicker of the story, so to speak. The Liberty County Sheriff's Office descended upon the home of these peaceful people because a psychic, no, really a psychic, had told them that there was a mass grave in the backyard because she had visioned it. There wasn't anybody missing to be in the mass grave in the first place. A psychic with the made-up name Angel, listed as a John Doe in the complaint, went to the Liberty County Sheriff's Office and said she had had a vision of a mass grave at that address. And the Liberty County Sheriff's Office response was to say, one Adam 12, see the mass grave behind the... A psychic. I guess from the Psychic Fiends Network. A psychic. I guess psychics have bad days, too. But at what point did right-wing places like Texas lose even the ability to recognize that maybe you ought not be descending upon a person's home when your only evidence is derived from somebody who said they saw it in their mind? Lawyer Andrew B. Summerman told the Dayton News not a single body was found buried in the backyard. This all started with a psychic who gave the sheriff's office a tip. A bad psychic who... There are good ones? A bad psychic who had given the sheriff's office tips in the past that were wrong. In other words, she'd gone to the sheriff's office before with other mass graves and visions and stuff. And the Liberty County, Texas Sheriff's Department said, let's roll. And all manner of media then, circus-like, descended upon these poor people's home. The only response offered by the Liberty County Sheriff's Office came from Liberty County Sheriff Henry Patterson, who said, this situation was handled okay on our end. I am not worried about our part of it. Everyone at that location, the media, was told that nothing was going on and we couldn't stop what happened. But something was going on. The daggum backyard was being dug up. The people were being rousted, their homes searched, on allegations that they were sitting smack dab on top of a mass grave. Well, see, this is where you guys come in. A little background. Email. No surprise to me at all. Neighboring county to where I came up. Redneck and racist and dirt ignorant to the nth degree. Liberty County, Texas. Exactly, Marty. Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Marty also noting some psychics are better than others. So are some con artists. Kevin with the query, aren't Christians supposed to stay away from mediums and psychics and stuff, if I remember my Bible correctly? Picking and choosing again, just like they do, I guess. Because, I mean, you just know that the sheriff of Liberty County, Texas, is a Bible-believing Christian. Right? Again, little things that are obvious to the rest of us that are lost on a significant portion of the population of this country. No mention of the Hearst Corp being sued. Maybe for once the editorial staff said, why don't we lay off this one? This might be another one of Angel cases. Little tiny things that are obvious to the rest of us that are totally freaking lost on the vast majority of the right wing in this country. And one more little piece of evidence of the same. A piece of legislation. Not proposed legislation, but rather legislation that has been passed out of the legislative body for the governor's signature. The state and all political subdivisions may not adopt or implement policy recommendations that deliberately or inadvertently infringe or restrict private property rights without due process, as may be required by policy recommendations originating in or traceable to Agenda 21, adopted by the United Nations in 1992 at its Conference on Environment and Development, or any other international law or ancillary plan of action that contravenes the Constitution of the United States or the Constitution of the State. The name of the state is actually contained in the legislation. Would anyone care to... shall we make a game of this? Would anyone care to guess? If there's anything to be good to be had out of this legislation, maybe it's the fact that if this had been the law in the state of Texas, maybe those folks wouldn't have had their backyard dug up. But, well, no, because there's nothing about... Agenda 21 that motivated the Liberty County, Texas Sheriff's Office to go and dig up the backyard. You'd think when the body sniffing, body finding dogs show up and just wind up just sitting back on their haunches and scratching behind their own ears with their rear, with their hind leg, that maybe that would have been a clue. Well, Fred, I don't think we got to dig. Rover over here ain't always doing it again. Damn. Now I'll give you a couple of minutes. You wanna place a bet on where the statute's coming from? Or do you just want the answer straight up? It can happen either way. All right, I'll go ahead and tell you. The state of Alabamistan, you kind of knew, didn't you? Didn't you know it was going to be Alabama or Mississippi or Georgia? Maybe Tennessee, possibly Arkansas. Oklahoma would have been pretty easy, too. Kansas wouldn't have been a stretch. Missouri's in the realm of possibility. But when you come right down home to it, the state that tried to outlaw homosexual references and homosexual authors from books to be in the libraries of the state of Alabama, same people, right? This is what happens when you let the Koch brothers write your legislation for you. Because the Koch brothers and the teabaggers are all head up about Agenda 21, you know, that happened 20 years ago. They're just right now having the 20th anniversary of the Rio Conference in Rio. Nothing, of course, will happen. Because the United States will actively work to make sure that nothing happens. The real name of Agenda 21, which has way too many words for your average bagger, is the Rio Declaration on Environment and Development. The Koch brothers recognize it, as do the teabaggers, as the vast international conspiracy to take away our freedom with windmills and solar panels. Really? Really, really. And I'll go ahead and tell you one other thing that kind of really creeps me out about this is that the meeting that I have to attend after I leave Washington, D.C. is in Alabamistan. And the legislature of the state of Alabama, elected overwhelmingly by Alabamians, has just passed a law that makes it impossible for the state of Alabama to pass any other law that would speak to the needs of the people of the state of Alabamistan with regard to clean air or clean water. For all it says, it pretty much it comes damned close to actually shutting down the Alabama Department of Environmental Quality, such as it is. Sustainability. Now, this is an excellent blog post by R.P. Siegel over at triplepundit.com. R.P. Siegel writes, at the risk of being struck down by lightning, I actually looked at the document itself, and here's what I found. Human beings are at the center of concerns for sustainable development. They are entitled to a healthy and productive life in harmony with nature. States shall cooperate in a spirit of global partnership. See, that's it. Globalism! That's that one world government that John Birchers was warning us about on the Alan Stang report way back in the 1970s. States shall cooperate in a spirit of global partnership to conserve, protect, and restore the health and integrity of the Earth's ecosystem. See, they're worshiping the false god of the Earth. The right to development must be fulfilled so as to equitably meet developmental and environmental needs of present and future generations. I think R.P. Siegel must be familiar with the language because he says in the next paragraph, I suspect it's this last one that has folks riled up. We don't like no equity around here, especially the folks at the bottom. Siegel continues, that seems to be a uniquely American phenomenon. Once again, a significant portion of the population of the United States of America cannot comprehend the most basic and essential of facts, otherwise recognized as downright mundane by the rest of us. Because, and I don't routinely like to use a whole bunch of bad words, even an Alabamian can tell you, you don't shit in your nest. Whereas this bill says, everybody come on over here and have a squat. Stunning. Utterly and absolutely stunning. Ron and Raleigh reminding us all, hey, Bob, remember Alabama outlawed the possession of marital aids. When marital aids are outlawed, only outlaws will have marital aids. Hear, hear. Hear, hear. Jay writing in from Yuma. Bob, I lived and worked in Liberty County, Texas for 12 years. Rednecks nearly one and all. It's just across the... See, this is one of them damn language moments. Proper Spanish would be San Jacinto, but no, I think it's the San Jacinto. It's just across the San Jacinto River from the place where the guy killed the school teacher last week. Oh, Jesus, no. You know, these dumb bastards want to build a wall across the border of the United States when I've got a feeling we ought to build a wall around them. And a big old Logan's Run kind of dome, too. Keep all the stupid from getting out. Jeebus. And then, just one more little item. Dr. John and I were talking about this. That points, again, to failures of comprehension on almost a systemic level. I saw this story quoted, I think Lottie did it in the chat room last night. And the headline is quite fascinating, and I just love this kind of stuff, because I kind of love the speculative stuff that says that. I mean, I'm fascinated by it. I don't hold it up as true, and I try generally not to do any believing at all. But it's fun like going to the zoo. Bones in Bulgaria, maybe of John the Baptist, study. Particularly depressing that this comes from Agence France-Presse. I thought better of them. the lead to the story begins quite spectacularly, titillatingly even, perhaps. Scientists have found new evidence, they say, supports the theory that a knuckle bone and other human remains found under a church floor in Bulgaria may be of John the Baptist. What? Really? John the Baptist? The one that baptized Jesus and everything? Yeah, that John the Baptist. The relics found in a small marble sarcophagus 2 years ago on a Bulgarian island called Sweaty Ivan, which translates as Sweaty John, also included a... Okay, Sveti Ivan, which translates as Saint John, also included a human tooth, part of a skull, and three animal bones. I thought the Bible said he lived on locusts and wild honey. I didn't know that locust pieces could hang out that long. A research team from Oxford University dated the right-handed knuckle bone to the 1st century A.D. when John is believed, big blinking red lights ought to be in bold-faced italic 25-point, believed to have lived until his beheading ordered by King Herod, the university said in a statement. Journalism moment, that makes it sound like that the university said in a statement that John the Baptist was ordered beheaded by King Herod, which if there's any direct evidence on it, I would love to see it. But that's the nature of this kind of crap that goes wandering off into the series of tubes and comes out with people, Muriel, this is amazing. All them atheists is going to drop dead right here this minute. They done found the knuckle bone of John the Baptist. Hallelujah, glory, hand me a snake, Muriel. Call Cousin Marveline and let her know. This will give her a spiritual uplift. Scientists from the University of Copenhagen analyzed the DNA of the bones, finding they came from a single individual, probably a man, from a family. In the modern-day Middle East, where John would have lived 2,000 years ago. But it says it's from the modern-day Middle East. Which is it? Do we have any editors left? Did they all get on the ship and go to the other planet? Question. Any guesses how many people lived between, say, one of the current era and 100 of the current era? And if we have a general idea of what that number is, can we guess reasonably well at what percentage of that number in those 100 years or so were people who lived in the Middle East of its day? If you wanted to be accurate, wouldn't you say, a man from a family in what we now call the Middle East, but was then known as Palestine. So what they know is they've got the knuckle bone and a tooth of a dead Palestinian from the 1st century. And then you get the real sad news. The National Geographic Channel has turned it into a documentary about the discovery of the knuckle bone and tooth of John the Baptist. Bulgarian archaeologists have found a small box made of hardened volcanic ash close to the sarcophagus. Okay. This Sunday, the documentary will air on the National Geographic Channel in Great Britain. Muriel, oh Muriel, do come here. The box made of hardened volcanic ash that they don't tell us whether is routinely to be found in the modern-day Middle East, as they say, bore inscriptions in ancient Greek. Really? Ancient Greek? Not Koine? Because, you know, the whole New Testament was ultimately first published in Koine Greek, not ancient Greek like you read if you go off and decide to learn Greek and read the Iliad and the Odyssey and stuff. The box bore inscriptions in ancient Greek that referred to John the Baptist and the date that Christians celebrate his birth, June 24th. It must be. Many sites around the world claim to hold relics of the saint, including the Grand Mosque in Damascus, which says it has his head. Oh boy, oh boy. Let's match up the bones. Let's match up that knuckle bone with some of that skull bone. And if they match up, it's John the Baptist, right? Wrong. Because this article is a classic display of the utter lack of scientific understanding that pervades so much of the world. The shoe, follow the shoe, I want to worship the box. With the ancient Greek on it. Sing me, O muse. Craziness. Because you see, if you was to match up the knuckle bone and the head bone, if they've actually got the head bone there at the Grand Mosque in Damascus, and they matched up and they was definitely the same feller, you would know that you had the head and knuckle bone and tooth of one guy out of God knows how many millions who existed in the 100 years in what was then Palestine, only one of whom might possibly, if the legend turns out to be true, have been John the Baptist. Or Sweaty Ivan. The findings of another Oxford researcher using historical documents suggest that the monastery of Sweaty Ivan may have received a portion of John the Baptist's relics in the 5th or early 6th centuries. So that means that for 400 years, they weren't the relics of John the Baptist. You do know that the locals there, when the Christians decided to start putting up monasteries and temples and churches and the edifices and whatnot, were notorious for standing on the street corner looking for somebody wearing a cross and offering to sell them a piece of the true cross. The mother of Constantine the Great went to the so-called Holy Land and brought back hunks of the true cross. Sold to her, I have no doubt, by a true businessman. You think, given the length of time that that land was occupied, there might have been a... My God! Outside, what is it? Outside the boundaries of Jerusalem itself, there was a place called Sheol? Where are you when I need you, Texas Betsy? A sort of potter's field where people's remains were thrown who couldn't get properly buried or whatever it was. Bones were just rolling around. I seek the remains of John the Baptist, for I had a vision that he is buried in a mass grave here. Oh, yes, he is. He was. We dug him up. Would you like to buy him? Ron and Raleigh, you got me. Now, wait a minute. Hey, Bob, according to our Christian friends, carbon dating's not reliable, right? So how do these goobers date this knuckle bone? Carbon dating. Can't date a dinosaur bone, but you can date a saint's knuckle. Got it. Thank you, Dr. John San Jacinto. Yes, Marty, I'm convinced all the remaining editors are warping out even as I'm speaking. Marty also observing, that's the Rupert Murdoch influence on National Geographic. Such a shame for what was a great network. Isaac pointing out, ignorance is the mother of all religion, and religion is the mother of all hate. More language fun. See, this is why places like Texas and other are difficult for me. Dr. John pointing out, near my boyhood home is a peninsula jutting into Galveston Bay. It's Bolivar Peninsula, named for Simon Bolivar, the freedom fighter who supported Texas' independence from Mexico. Of course, it's not pronounced Bolivar, but Bolivar. Thanks for the phonetics, Dr. John. So, do we have a theme? If we do, let's work it, or not. Whatever you want to bring to the table is fine. You know the phone lines are open, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. On your nickel, 304-658-3333, and we have proudly added to the lineup of availabilities of means by which one may contact the program, Skype. All you need to do is search Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N, and send a request. I'll add you to the contacts, and we can have a Skype conversation, if you so desire. I can proudly announce that, having said that we needed to reach a $300 threshold this evening, we are $150 of the way there. Thank you. Thank you very much. I can't tell you how badly it is needed, because I know what's going to dry up next week. This is our last big push for June, so you won't have to listen to this much more. Thank you. If we can get to 300, it'll be magnificent. So, light up the phones. It's Friday on the front porch, and the last chat we'll have for a while, I reckon. And we'll be back. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You are, in fact, listening to the horn.
But I give it to the rhythm and my feet. Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Three minutes before the hour, we are halfway through this evening's program. The filibuster is over. And let us go forthwith. By the way, we're up to 160 now. Only 14 more members of the Thrifty 250 to get us where we sort of de minimis need to be. Thank you for your help. Thank you very, very much. And enough shilly-shally. Hey, welcome to the program. Hey, welcome to the program. Someday, I will have a producer. Well, I do know that we have Thomas with us via Skype. Hey, Thomas. Are you there? Well, try me back. These things happen. That's our first unsuccessful Skype call. And yeah, everything, I know, I'm just getting it. No, everything's where it needs to be. Anyway, we will move along. Okay, we'll disconnect and try again. See, this is why producers come in handy, so that the talking person can keep talking. More filibobstering, says Marty. No, I ain't got it in me. But there are... Yeah, well, there is this. I want to make sure that this gets out on this Friday on the front porch. It is an older, dated piece. News Ninja Gene sent this along, I suspect, having heard me make reference to it. The guy that I am... that I've been talking about lately is a fella, two people... one is the author of this article, Brian Basham. The other is a person by the name of Clive R. Boddy, B-O-D-D-Y. Basham writes from back in 2011, "Over the years I've met my fair share of monsters, rogue individuals for the most part. But as regulation in the UK and the US has loosened its restraints, the monsters have proliferated. In a paper," and again, this is 2011, "in a paper recently published in the Journal of Business Ethics entitled The Corporate Psychopaths, Theory of the Global Financial Crisis, Clive R. Boddy identifies these people as psychopaths. They are," he says, "simply," and how convenient that it works out this way, "they are," he says, "simply the 1% of people who have no conscience or empathy. Psychopaths, rising to key senior positions, within modern financial corporations, where they are able to influence the moral climate of the whole organization and yield considerable, and I suspect that means wield considerable power, have largely caused the banking crisis. Mr. Basham also references John Ronson's widely acclaimed book, The Psychopath Test, in which a professor by the name of Robert Hare told Mr. Ronson, "I should have spent some time inside the stock exchange as well. Serial killer psychopaths ruin families. Corporate and political and religious psychopaths ruin economies. They ruin societies." Mr. Basham writes, "Cut to a pleasantly warm evening in Bahrain. My companion, a senior UK investment banker, and I are discussing the most successful banking types we know and what makes them tick. I argue that they often conform to the characteristics displayed by social psychopaths. To my surprise, my friend agrees. He then makes an astonishing confession. Quote, at one major investment bank for which I worked, we used psychometric testing to recruit social psychopaths because their characteristics exactly suited them to senior corporate finance roles. Now, maybe somebody else, some other broadcaster, has talked about this in the past. But I suspect everything being alleged here to be actually factual. Mr. Ronson, Mr. Basham continues, Mr. Ronson spoke to scores of psychologists about their understanding of the damage that psychopaths could do to society. None of those psychologists could have imagined, I'm sure, the existence of a bank that used the science of spotting them as a recruiting mechanism. I've never met Dick Fuld, he says, the former CEO of Lehman Brothers and the architect of its downfall, but I've seen him on video and it's terrifying. He snarled to Lehman staff that he wanted to rip out their hearts and eat them before they died. That's a quote. So how did someone like Mr. Fuld get to the top of Lehman? You don't need to see the video to conclude he was weird, and you could take a little more time and read a 2,200-page report by Anton Valukas, the Chicago-based lawyer hired by a U.S. court to investigate Lehman's failure. Mr. Valukas revealed systemic chicanery within the bank. He described management failures and a destructive internal culture of reckless risk-taking worthy of any psychopath. This thing kind of needs to be recycled and put back out there for common consumption, you know, as soon as they're done with their excitement over the discovery of the knuckle of John the Baptist. Mr. Basham continues, why wasn't Mr. Fuld spotted and stopped? I've concluded it's the good old question of nature and nurture, but with a new interpretation. As I see it, in its search for never-ending growth, the financial services sector has actively sought out monsters with natures like Mr. Fuld and nurtured them with bonuses and praise. We all understand that sometimes businesses have to be cut back to ensure their survival, and where those cuts should fall is as relevant to a company as it is today to the UK economy. Should it bear down upon the rich or the poor? Making the cuts doesn't make psychopaths of the cutters, but the financial sector's lack of remorse for the pain it encourages people to inflict is purely psychopathic. Surely the action of cutting should be a matter for sorrow and regret. People's lives are damaged, even destroyed. However, that's not how the financial sector sees it. Take Sir Fred Goodwin of RBS, for example, Royal Bank of Scotland. By the way, they participate in mountaintop removal. Ever seen a picture of Don Blankenship? Ever heard him talk? Get my point? Like hangs with like. Take Sir Fred Goodwin of RBS, for example. Before he racked up a corporate loss of £24.1 billion, the highest in UK history, he was idolized by the city, meaning London. In recognition of his work in ruthlessly cutting costs at Clydesdale Bank, he got the nickname Fred the Shred, and he played that for all it was worth. He was later described as a corporate Attila, a title of which any psychopath would be proud. Mr. Ronson reports justice departments and parole boards all over the world have accepted Hare's contention that psychopaths are quite simply incurable and everyone should concentrate their energies instead on learning how to root them out. Here's the thing, the part that should make the little hairs stand up on the back of your neck, or possibly, if you think about it later on tonight, make you sit up at 3 o'clock in the morning with beads of sweat running down from your hairline. Cold, cold sweat. Justice departments and parole boards all over the world have accepted Hare's contention that psychopaths are quite simply incurable and everyone should concentrate their energies instead on learning how to root them out. But, far from being rooted out, they are still in place and often in positions of even greater power. Can you imagine putting a Sheldon Adelson on the couch and running him through a quick DSM-4 battery? You know, many years ago, horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner and I made a little bit of noise over the fact that Rick took out the requisites from the DSM-4 of a sociopath and in a live on-air conversation, without telling me what those characteristics were, simply asked me question by question by question, could I fit any of the conduct of George W. Bush into the things that he read off? And if I recall correctly, there were like 12 characteristics. Don't hold me to that part. There were 12 characteristics, and every time horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner would read off a characteristic, I was bang, right there, with something George W. Bush had done in the course of his life. No, I remember reading about it, Honored to Dystopia, but I have not seen the film or read the book American Psycho. I trust it's on point. Well, when we got done with the list, however many characteristics there were, Rick said, Bob, do you know what you just did? I said, no, really, I don't. He said, you've just definitively diagnosed George W. Bush, the President of the United States, as a sociopath. And he said, here's the fun part. In order to qualify as a sociopath, you only have to meet 5 of these characteristics, and you just did all 12, Bob. If George W. Bush was not filthy freaking rich, he'd be chewing the soft, soft walls in a nice, safe room somewhere where he couldn't hurt society. Those of you who are old enough will remember that one of the other nefarious things that Ronnie Reagan did was, under the guise of being humane, the Reagan administration set about dismantling what little state-level mental health systems there were in this country and so-called mainstreaming people who really shouldn't have been in society. Looking back on that now, I realize that's because maybe the other side was realizing just exactly who they were dealing with, and they didn't want to run the risk of winding up in a state hospital, you know, with the Hannibal Lecter mask on. Yeah, you're right, Marty. Imagine Ted Bundy as a Wall Street trader. Pretty easy, huh? Not much of a stretch at all. But when we see things going on in our world and we don't understand them, and they are coming from the corridors of intensely concentrated power, and we see how brutal and hate-filled they are, how unconcerned they are with the ongoing miseries of ordinary people simply trying to get through from day to day to day. And we say to ourselves, how could you do that to people? The answer is actually simpler than it would otherwise appear to be. They're psychopaths. They're sociopaths. They are the... What was that phrase again? Worth remembering that. They are simply the 1% of people who have no conscience or empathy. Now, this is before any Arab Spring started. This is before any Occupy started. This is from December 2011. This is before ever the first poster went up that said, we are the 99%. That makes this valuable. They are simply the 1% of people who have no conscience or empathy. They are not limited to this country or any other. And they owe no allegiance to any flag, any creed, any nationality. Because that involves some degree of empathy, sympathy, maybe even conscience. And they are utterly bereft of it all and are able to think only of themselves and their own well-being. And if that is not the living definition of the 1%, I am at a loss to explain what is. An argument such as that put forward by Ayn Rand, that there is some sort of nobility of selfishness, is again a manifestation of psychopathy. When right-wingers and Republicans giggle that greed is good, parroting that line from the Oliver Stone film Wall Street, that is a manifestation of psychopathology. I've been meaning to bring that to you. And again, I'm sorry, maybe... Well, damn, Bob, I heard that a year ago. Even if you did, it is worth, in this era, reinforcing. With the entirety of Europe teetering on the brink of disaster and us tethered to them by leg manacles, both of us staring down into the abyss and having the abyss stare back, it is worth noting. It is worth noting that psychopaths are the 1%. Because if they flame out, they don't care if we go with them. And if they can keep from flaming out by subjecting innocent citizens of Greece or Italy or Spain or Portugal or Ireland or you to heart-rending misery, more the merrier for them. Second Star Trek reference of the evening. Do you remember the character, Mr. What's-His-Name, who turns out to be this intergalactic demon thing that feeds on human anguish or living anguish, not even human, anything or anyone, anguish, fear, misery? Same. You know? And I just wanted to get that out there. To the phones we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's John in upstate New York.
John, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, I gotcha. A little moment of food porn here, if that's okay.
Oh, yeah.
Got my ribs in the smoke, and my hot slaw's been sitting out all day long, so it's going to be...
So the hot slaw's working out for you?
That changed my life, I got to say. Absolutely.
There is a possibility that on this trip I may swing through the home of where the hot slaw comes from and get the real thing, and I'm eager. Oh my God, I can't wait! It just happens to be on the way home.
That's really amazing. I mean, I gather that you and my wife grew up really close to each other. She's from outside of Huntsville, so that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, no more than 72 miles distant.
Nice. Actually, speaking of your trip, that was really getting my question. But I wanted to say real quick regarding George W. Bush and your sort of psychopathology talk there. I'm a native Texan, right? And we have, I think, gifted the country with some pretty good things. I mean, we gave you guys Molly Ivins and Jim Hightower, and although they were flawed, you know, Sam Rayburn and Lyndon Johnson and, you know, all that stuff. And then all of a sudden we drop George W. Bush and you guys. And I mean, talk about karmic imbalance.
Then again, he was Connecticut still has some splaining to do over the Bushes.
Well, if we can share the blame, that would be great. I'd love that. But yeah, I mean, it's really late to the party, but, God, apologies. You know?
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah. So what I really just called to ask was, I was wondering if you could tell us anything about, anything more about what you're going to be doing these next couple of weeks, because I'm excited to hear it, and I know it's a serious hit on, sort of the Horn's finances, but this is really important work that benefits everybody. So I was wondering if you could say anything else about what's going on.
Well, the first part of it has to do with the AIC Act.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a trip to Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
From there, I leave and take roads south to wind up in Selma, Alabama.
Hmm.
And, of course, Selma is fraught with horror and history, or perhaps the history of horror.
Yeah.
I will see the, and I've never seen it, I will see the Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Oh, the Pettus Bridge. Excellent. Wow.
And I will be attending a meeting of magnificent Southern activists who work for economic and social justice behind the cornbread curtain.
Uh-huh.
And we are, the Cold River Mountain Watch is allied with them, and I have been asked to attend that meeting for Cold River Mountain Watch and report back. Because you know, the one thing that a lot of people don't realize, John, especially people outside the South, is that, and that's why I constantly kind of harp on this, there are incredibly talented, incredibly brilliant, incredibly dedicated people who are not ignorant right-wingers who don't understand things that you and I commonly take for granted as the ordinary workings of the everyday average human brain. There are lots of those people, and they are working tirelessly and in some ways harder because the circumstances are harder behind the red curtain, or as Reverbo would say, down behind the possum line.
Well, absolutely. I think we write off the South to our great detriment, and yeah, there's enormous problems there. But like I said last night when you were talking about that really amazing study about the Googling habits and the vote differential. I mean, how many of the places that you mentioned where people were Googling, you know, racial, you know, nonsense and not voting for Obama were in the North? I mean, you mentioned upstate New York and western PA and eastern Ohio. You know, the South doesn't have a lock on ignorance.
Oh, no, no, no.
The West Coast and the Northeast does not have a lock on progressive ideas.
Not at all. Not at all. I take it, well, he said, you recall the report said that that word was Googled with about the same frequency as Lakers are in L.A.
Right.
I'm assuming that to be a rather horrifying number, John.
I would imagine. That's what I thought.
But those places, you know, eastern Ohio, you know, it's practically West Virginia. West Virginia, according to this study, being the single most racist state in the United States. You know, Pennsylvania, upstate New York. Frankly, those all share a common characteristic, and one that makes me particularly grieve. That's all Appalachia, John.
The Appalachia thing. Yeah, absolutely. And it should make you fight mad the same way that, you know, foisting George W. Bush on and that nonsense story about the teacher who got, you know, gunned down and stand your ground makes me angry as a Texan, because I know good people there and I know the problems they face and I know how changing a little bit of a mind would vastly improve the lives of so many people. And it makes me angry when I see these things. I don't write it off, and I don't think, well, that's what the South is like, because A, it's everywhere, and B, that's not the whole story. And so it's great to hear that you're going down there.
I'm looking forward to it. I really and truly am. Although, at the same time, I'm not kidding when I say I'm scared. I am scared to return to the state of my birth. Not because I have anything to hide, John, but because that place has gone And not retail crazy. That place has gone wholesale crazy.
Oh yeah, it's Sam's Club crazy. It's Costco crazy. Absolutely. Well, my wife's home this coming week, and she's down there, and I'm a little bit concerned about that too. You know, she can't start talking her like, you know, northeastern liberal shit down there because
no,
what'll happen?
No. I mean, you know, it's like don't travel alone.
Yeah.
Go, you know, have, you know, and you know, how lunatic is this, John, that we're talking about the fact that in one of the states of the United States, regardless of where you are, that you have to use the buddy system.
Yeah, right. Go.
This
yeah,
is not. This should. Like, this is the United States. This should not be cliff diving.
This isn't deep sea diving. That's what I was going to say. Exactly. Right. This isn't, you know, death at one turn if you don't have a friend with you. And I mean, and that. That sounds like we're making light, but I mean, you know what you're talking about. I know what I'm talking about. And it's really nice, and I've said this to you before. It's nice to hear. I love hearing people with Southern accents talking sense, you know, and it comes from you, and it comes from Edward, and it comes from Jim, and it comes from, Juanita and other people that call into the show. And it's really important. I mean, the South has given us so much in terms of, you know, food and music and ideas and it's just it's a wonderful place and it's not the kind of thing that we need to just carve off and let sail out to sea like the Southerners wanted to do to Massachusetts, you know.
Right, but I'm really wondering if maybe there's something to be said for that wall, John.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, the people that want to build the wall want to keep the wrong folks out. As far as I can tell, they want to keep the hardworking folks out. Right.
Well, exactly. And, yeah. But I want to keep the crazies in.
At least you can monitor them that way, I guess. Well, I'm really pleased to hear that you're doing this activism work, because it does benefit everybody, and I know you're going to take a hit, and I would just really encourage everyone, if there's going to be a month this calendar year that they can make an extra sacrifice and kick something towards the horn to keep us going. That would be really wonderful, and it sounds like this would be the month to do it, because you've taken two big hits, and this is really important work, and I would just really encourage folks, if they can, to contribute.
Thank you very, very, very much, John. A quick email just came from our buddy David in South Carolina.
David, I forgot David. I'm sorry. Yes.
Well, no. and under the subject line, crazy. And David simply says, went to grocery store, forgot I was wearing an Obama T-shirt. Had to keep my eyes open. Really?
Wow. I believe it. Absolutely. No question.
And so, and there are so many joyful things to celebrate. You know, talking about going to the home of the hot slaw. I hope, and I trust he isn't, that my surgeon is not listening. Because if they're open, because they burned down not too long back, but a friend of mine down there tells me they have rebuilt with a vengeance.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to be like the children of Israel before the Sabbath, gathering extra manna to get them through the next day.
Oh yeah.
I'm gonna load up on barbecue and hot dogs. Because one of the tricks about the hot slaw, John, is that it is absolutely stunning on hot dogs. It's just like one little stripe of ketchup, and then a load of that hot slaw, and they press it in some sort of flat iron. I use two hot iron skillets when I make them here, so the outsides of the buns are crispy and toasty, and they are probably the cheapest weenies known to man.
Yeah,
and they are, and this extends back to the dim and distant days of my childhood. They are exquisite.
Wow.
And so, yeah, I mean, it almost takes on the quality of a pilgrimage.
I love it. I got to try that, and I say take that Chicago and New York. Both great cities. Love the folks there, but love the hot dogs. But my God, that sounds amazing.
Oh, you drop no. This is paradigm shift stuff. If you were to drop these hot dogs in Chicago and New York, it would be revolutionary. The entire hot dog cultures of both cities would change.
Would change overnight. I love everything about my wife, but I got to say one of the more amazing things is that she introduced me to white sauce.
It's never been
the same.
Yeah, it can't be, and that's amazing. Yeah. Now, see, we got a little clarification to do here, John. Marty just wrote in and said, "Isn't hot slaw, aka sauerkraut?"
No. Good stuff also, but this is different. You better take it from here, Bob.
I will. And here's the trick. Trying to engage in a little cultural exchange and stuff. I left written in English. I left the recipe for hot slaw in Germany.
Wow.
I mean, this is a nation that went wild over the idea of putting curry-flavored ketchup on bratwurst.
Oh, that's right. Oh, man. This could change everything overnight.
Yeah, I just want to know that it's happened. You know, yeah. I don't know, maybe go back in a year's time and suddenly, would you like a verse with the hot slaw on it?
Yes. An investment hot slaw. Yeah. Well, I've got some friends in Germany, so I'll put out a discreet query and see if they pick up on it.
You know, it's just the Colombian exchange running backwards, John.
Oh yeah, exactly.
You know, we take something as ubiquitous as the kohlrabi, the cabbage, that clearly is European, made its way over here, transformed it into something wonderful and magnificent, and shipped it back.
Yeah. Yep, and to Europe, you're welcome.
yeah, because things will change. Things will change.
Things will change.
John, have a wonderful weekend, and thank you very kindly for the call.
You too, sir. Have a great trip, and I look forward to hearing about it when you get back.
Thanks. There will be a trip report. And like I said, Facebooking and tweeting along the way.
Excellent. All right, good night.
All right, bye now. Dr. John calling from New York. Onward we go. Line's open if you want to jump in. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob, how you doing?
Pretty good, Bill. How about you?
I can't complain. Nobody listens, you know? Well, yeah, the shrinker listened and the bartender listened, but they both cost an awful lot, you know? It's one of those things. But seriously speaking, could you run by those dates by me again on the history?
The American History Prism series?
Yeah.
July 2nd and 3rd?
Yep.
5th and 6th?
Okay.
And 9th.
Okay. Yeah, it's nice to get a free education.
And this is that, Bill. It absolutely is.
Those guys know their stuff.
I mean, we'll be starting at 9 o'clock in the morning, and some evenings we may not finish up till 9.
Oof. See, I'm weak in the revolutionary and constitutional period. After that, I got that Civil War. You start looking at that, and it's like opening up a big river. Because there's so many other aspects, and learning is funny that way. I got so heavily involved in listening to New Orleans jazz, which you begin to learn a lot of social things from, like the New Orleans funeral. First of all, a lot of people buried with music in those days, a lot of different groups, And a lot of it in New Orleans came from the fact that getting life insurance was not easy if you were black.
Right.
And you belonged to your lodge, and the part of the lodge insurance was the use of a band. And there's some... I have a great recording by this young Tuxedo Brass Band that Erdogan sent Tommy Dowd to New Orleans in 59. And they recorded these guys, and they young. Are you kidding me? These guys were pretty darn old then. But, man, and the clarinetist uses an E-flat clarinet because it carries outside strongly. It's a high, you know, high-pitched.
Right.
And you being of Scotch descent, you'd get this feeling like, that reminds me of a bagpipe.
Yeah, true. Yeah, like the business part of a bagpipe.
Yep. Yeah, the tonality is wailing. This guy was named John Kazmir, who was leading the band at that time and playing the E-flat, and what a sound. There's a lot of great bands down there now. Trombone Shorty, and there's a program on college radio here in Cleveland on Monday morning called Fat Monday, P-H-A-T. And when I wake up listening to the guys I have on record that have been dead since 65, and you never thought you'd hear them on a radio channel. You know, I have a good collection of that stuff. I should sell it. But you're going to be gone a long time. I'll miss the hell out of you, Bob. But,
there will be reruns, Bill.
Yeah.
But...
Well, it has to be done, man. Bless you, because you hit it right on the head. And I had some interesting encounters with young men from West Virginia in the 1950s, mid-50s. Some of them weren't real friendly. But, hey, none of them ever resorted to guns and clubs either. You know, it was that typical, let's play football. In the middle of the game, somebody will throw a punch at somebody. You know, that kid stuff. Typical.
Well, but again, you know, this kind of goes back to, I mention him a lot because I miss him horribly, Joe Bajant. You know,
yeah.
you can go to joebajant.com and just spend days there. But that one brilliant essay that he wrote called Eat, Pray, Fight.
Yeah.
Is an exploration of what it is to be Southern and Scots-Irish.
Yeah.
And to try to understand why it is that many of us will throw a punch as quick as look.
Well, Senator Webb, you know.
Yeah, that said much the same thing.
Yeah, he let, I mean, I...
But if you want writing style, there's no beating Joe.
Oh, no, absolutely. And the people he hung with out there in Colorado, and what did he do? Was it Denver? He was out there with some of the old Beat Generation people who were out there.
Oh, yeah. New Timothy Leary, new Dr. Thompson, right.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a great place to go. He wasn't a writer when he went out there, was he? Really?
No, he was. He had a hint that he wanted to, but it wasn't the origin. He was just kind of being a young guy at loose ends and trying to figure out what he wanted to do with his life after getting out of the Navy. I think that's how it went.
Man, what a great...
You know, couldn't hardly bear to go back and you know go up Shanghai Road and live there.
Yeah,
and carved out a niche for himself and did so brilliantly. Like I said, there is, if you just start with one and start following the links.
Yeah, I heard some of the interviews he did. I got those off the net.
Well, somewhere back there, and I searched when we heard that he had passed away. I searched my emails. I asked other people to search their emails. Joe Bajant remains to this day the only individual in the history of the Horn to whom I have ever given the entire body of a show. And there is somewhere in the archives, if anybody wants to go searching, there is a 3-hour conversation with Joe Bajant that is, I was wrapped.
Well, you're strong on the mark yourself in the recent filibusters. You've been really What's the song Preach and Teach, buddy?
Yes, and you know, somebody, the choir needs preaching too sometimes.
Well, we all have to have it reinforced, because sometimes I'm getting so to the point of depression with this whole society that I start thinking, well, what do I do? Just go out and pick some guy out I don't like, smack him and get it over with? Because it's just getting tough to listen to these people.
Yeah, but see, that's the thing, Bill. You're not a psychopath, so you are. So even though you might think about it, you will, because you have a well-functioning brain, talk yourself out of it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I carry...
Under most circumstances.
I carried for quite a few years, depending where I was living in the city, in certain neighborhoods that were, you know... I came home from doing a job one night, and I'm getting out of my vehicle, and I'm getting some dog and cat food out of the side of my van. I was driving a van in those days, and I turn a world around, and there's four guys, construction crew. They had hammers, big monkey wrenches. Of course, it was 3:30 in the morning. And the guy says, well, we're righteous. And I said, well, you want to stay that way too, don't you? Because I was pointing at him. Who the hell are you? 3:30 in the morning in the inner city of Cleveland. And these guys were all Caucasian, by the way, in case anybody's wondering. So, you know, it's got nothing to do. Ethnicity's got nothing to do with this kind of stuff.
No.
Idiots come and desperate people come in all shapes, sizes, and one of these days I'll meet from one from Mars if I keep listening to that Nori at night, you know. You never know. Well, my mother had some books in the early 50s by some guy who lived on the slopes of Mount Palomar. I can't think of his name. Flying saucers have landed inside the spaceships. And they were quite interesting when I was like 13 or so, because some of these people that he was bumping into were really very, very nice creatures that had an ethic to them that, you know, the same one that Palestinian day laborer had.
Right. Stop hating on each other, stop killing each other.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. And I have a real hard time. I got a kick out of Jim. He's a show music listener and classical music. My sister was the complete opposite of me. Classically trained mezzo who listened to the opera every Saturday, and so did I, because it was loud. And the show music, I used to sit when I was messing with clarinet and play Get Me to the Church on Time and some of these other show tunes just for something to dabble with. One of my proudest jobs was in 75. We did two shows on a Sunday afternoon. You know, one where they clear the house between sets?
Yeah.
Shows? With Bonnie Raitt.
Oh, wow.
Oh, she was something else.
Yeah.
She grabbed my guitar player at that point in time and was trying to get him back to come back to the hotel with her. And this was a great guy. He said, no, I got to take care of all this equipment. I thought to myself, you moron, you. But that's another story. I think she was still wanting to, she was going to try to talk him into down the road and playing for her.
Gigging.
Yeah, because he was that damn. That kid was he was 17 when we opened for Cream at Grandy Ballroom in Detroit, and he was using a Sears 610 Dan Electro amp. Dan Electro was the guy who built a market under the Sears name. They were great amps. They were really strong.
Oh, yeah. I'm well familiar with the brand.
Yeah. You know, it was just a strange time, and I look back at it now and said, you know, I sometimes say, man, if you had been born into a middle-class household, you would have had a history degree and, you know, hopefully taught at some small college or high school or something, and retirement would be a lot easier than, you know, because, man, I miss playing like crazy. But a lot of blues up here now, but a lot of these guys never, ever listened to anybody, you know, except late model stuff.
Yeah. No, you got to go back to the roots, don't you?
That's where the guys like me who started in the mid-60s professionally, and even earlier amateurishly, so to speak, we had one hand deep in that market, deep in those in Muddy and Chess, and it was, the blues was all over the country. The stylistic differences are fantastically. The Texas guys ended up in Oklahoma, guys immigrating out to Oakland, and then meeting another Caucasian wild man, in this case, Johnny Otis, just, it was, you know, this guy, Louisiana Red, did you ever hear him?
I don't think so.
He did an LP in the early 60s, and it was real folkish from the effect that one of his songs was Red's Ride, and it was a chronicle of the reverse freedom ride that he was offered. You know, Citizens Committee giving away the fare, if you don't like the South Boy, go on away from here.
Yeah.
Somebody got to Little Rock, and they gave me, bought something to eat, but when I got my sandwich, I had to eat it on the street. You know, there was a story there.
You know, that reminds me, you having the, I didn't realize this was coming out, but you having the literary and musical bent that you do, this might mean something to you, Bill. And I know your vision is compromised, but still, I've wondered for a long time when this would actually be done, and apparently it has been. Not a lot of reviews out there yet, but here, I think in a few weeks, lo and behold, On the Road, Kerouac,
yeah,
is going to be released as a film, a major feature motion picture.
Oh, man, great. It's about time.
Well, it is. The question being, did they do the book justice? Did they do the era justice? And is it more than, you know, looking at faded photographs, if you know what I mean?
Yeah. I had that weird birth date of the mid-war, and I was a radio kid growing, you know, the first 5 or 6 years before we even had a television. And, you know, I was, these kids that I was hanging with calling themselves hippies, and they said, "Oh, you old beat, you." You know, so they used to give me a hard time about being a little older than them, you know. But, yeah, he said so much, and he caught, of course, he ended up pretty conservative in his old age, didn't he?
Well, he didn't have an old age.
Yeah, he was like 47, I think.
But he turned into this hard right-wing Vietnam-supporting drunk.
Yeah.
And wound up dying of some sort of massive hemorrhage after eating living with his mother in Florida, and died of a massive hemorrhage after eating a 1-pound can of tuna or something.
Jeez. Of course, with the stuff that might be in that, you know. I'm getting to a point, Bob, where everything, I've gone back to using a bread machine, baking my own bread again. My grandmother baked it, but she did it the old-fashioned way, you know.
Oh, I understand. And again, this is not some sort of elitism, but after my little jaunt across the pond, I can't find a loaf of bread anywhere that that even begins to compare. I mean, I've joked about the beer and everything, and it is amazing. But really, the lasting impression is the bread.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is the staff of life. And if you sit down with 2 or 3 slices of that out of a toaster and a little butter and maybe some cheese or meat,
yeah,
or just jam and butter.
Yeah.
One, the jam is not going to be made with high fructose corn syrup. The butter is not going to be made with bovine recombinant growth hormone milk. And the bread is not going to be made with GMO grains. And that bread is, by God, Bill, bread. I mean, it's dense, and it's rich, and it's flavorful, and it's not this gluey, cellulose-laden stuff that comes in a bag called marked Wonder, because it's a wonder the human system can digest it.
Yes, why is that? We have the same sense of humor in my line, where you wonder if it's bread or not.
Yeah, it's a wonder anybody can eat it.
Yeah, exactly. We're a couple of sick humorists, I'll tell you.
But no, I mean, I had that for breakfast every morning over there.
Well, yeah.
And you know, I'm somebody who likes to get up and, by God, have breakfast. And guess what? I felt like I had. By the way, you got some email in from Isaac. Isaac is a friend with a friend of George Clinton's.
Oh, my God.
And he said, Bill mentioned Trombone Shorty.
Yeah.
Bill has great taste. His real name is Troy Andrews, and he has done some shows with George.
Huh?
Great talent. In fact, it took me a minute to recognize the name, but you might remember some time back I was going down and doing broadcasts at West Virginia State University for our friends at Seneca 2. Well, at one point in time, they had either just gotten done or were about to host Trombone Shorty in a show there at West Virginia State.
My.
And it took me a minute for that light to go on, but yeah.
It's good to see these younger, you know, the Marcellus brothers, their dad, Ellis, was a piano teacher in New Orleans, and he jammed it down these guys' throats as to where they came from and the tradition of that city. And those guys could actually play older style jazz convincingly when you consider how much education they've had, you know, musical education. That's one of the differences.
Oh, like, yeah, the real old school stuff, the Big Spider Vic.
The guy I liked was this clarinetist named George Lewis. And when they rediscovered this trumpet player, Bunk Johnson, they put him with George's band. And Hal George was in Europe quite a bit. There was an YouTube of him and Acker Bilk doing Carina, the two clarinets just winding. Because Bilk was the guy who tried to steal George's style, you know, Stranger on the Shore. The big vibrato in there, that's New Orleans clarinetist. The French clarinet teacher could be pulling their hair out. Because it's so contrary to what classical players were taught.
Oh, without a doubt.
Although New Orleans, before Plessy and Ferguson took good hold, there was a Creole of color philharmonic or symphonic orchestra in New Orleans also. And then people were, you know, it's a whole different society that, you know, I had trouble as a kid because I was living in an integrated neighborhood, and I helped make it that way. And you get on we were running trackless trolleys in those days, and you get on, and you sat next to anybody. And when all this stuff hit the fan, you know, with this integration, I just couldn't understand what the problem was. No problem for me, you know. I went and sat and talked, and whoever the person was, you know, Jesus. Because it's a shame, because, I have a problem, Bob, sometimes with people with a Southern accent, and I don't like to, because, you know, it's not that way with everybody.
No, but when you hear so much ignorance being pronounced with it, it's hard not to associate one with the other.
Yeah, and it's a shame, because it shouldn't. I often ask myself how the Southern working class man could go out and charge cannon and mass musketry so that some rich guy could have a better shot, you know?
Right.
That's a crime, because these were some of the bravest. Who did the movie Gettysburg based on Killer Angels?
Was it Shiraz's book?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
I know. Ted Turner had a hand in the production of it.
That was the guy, yeah. And man, did that open my eyes to what I had been only able to visualize a lot in my mind as to what these guys did. How they did it, I'll never know. Well, of course, then again, I just lost my father-in-law, my second wife's father. He was on Saipan and Tinian and Iwo, and he broke his sons a few years ago into some of the things that he saw and didn't like done by American Marines. And then he said the kids told me it was real tough for him to talk about it. Things that he saw that were done to wounded people and prisoners and such that were not, you know, not what we're taught, you know.
Right.
Because that situation, anything's liable to happen.
And sure, and nobody, and in the midst of war, no one has a lock on, on morality.
You spent some time in Cleveland with your dad at the clinic, didn't you?
I did.
Well, I heard you speak of that. I've been in there. They've done a little work on me.
No, they saved my... There's no getting around. They bought my father another 10 years.
They know what they're doing. They've had some problems, believe it or not, with some staph infections and such, which makes you wonder about certain aspects. And I could tell you a good story, but I won't tonight, but a friend of mine who was an electrician there, that I heard from him, that hit the papers.
Well, my father was there, Bill, at a time when some sheikh or emir or sharif or whatever had an entire flora, and this was a nice thing to me, the whole hospital smelled of roasted lamb and and various, you know, various other Middle Eastern delicacies, and it was delightful.
Well, if you came out of the clinic walking onto Euclid Avenue and made a right turn and walked three-quarters of a mile in the late 50s, early 60s, you would have been in the middle of the our version of Storyville up here.
Really?
Well, that's where I was hanging out when I was 17. Great organ trios, and, you know, if you minded your own business and didn't bother anybody, nobody messed with you. That was a different situation. I don't know what's happened in our society now that, that we reach a point in so many areas of life where desperate people do desperately stupid things.
Well, I think there's that, but to a certain extent, in unofficial ways, there's a lot to point to the idea that this country is rapidly resegregating itself.
Yeah, yeah.
When you know, and officially as well, when you've got Southern senators of the United States saying, my state don't need to be regulated by the Voting Rights Act. We ain't lynched nobody in forever.
And you and I know that the things that Dr. King fought for in the 64 Civil Rights Bill had been in the Constitution since the post-Civil War era.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They were nothing new. They were things that were supposed to be a part of everybody in this society. Yeah, that area was a great one, and we also have a big market house up here which is celebrating 100th anniversary. City built it, and when they first laid it out, they were going to put in baths and washrooms because of it was opened 100 years ago this year, and that's how primitive it was in a big city. There was still a bathhouse on the route I took to my eighth grade school. Because at one point in my life, I was using the recreation center. Because the place I was living, my landlord, who was a friend of mine, he never bothered to do any plumbing work. And I wasn't about to do it for him. It's his house, you know. I did enough of my own when I owned him. Yeah, it was, so they're loaded with. They did a special on it on PBS up here, and the bakery should talk about this. And one German place, I buy there some of their rye bread, is just out of this world. And there's a woman who makes sourdough rye, which is...
Yeah.
I was thinking of Tracy the other week. I was coming back in a cab, and I had there's a young woman I have for an health aide who's as old as my daughter, and she's amazed by me. She says, you know, I work with people that... older folks, I haven't met one like you yet. I said, get ready, you're going to see a whole lot of them. When the boomers start to come into retirement, you know.
Right.
Because that whole 60s era was a different world, man. But anyway, I said something to my health aide about the 1%ers. And this young woman, well, I don't know, young, she was in her 50s, cab driver, just left to the defense of the Republican Party. I said, boy, keep talking. Your tip's getting smaller by the minute here, lady. it's hard for me to deal with. And one of my best friends who grew up with...
But you know what? I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, Bill, because the fact of the matter is, it's a tactic they use. I got a right-wing blast email from Donald Wildman of the American Family Association of Tupelo, Mississippistan, just yesterday, I think, saying, here is coffee you can drink without running the risk of supporting any liberals.
Yeah, I know Schultz has a big coffee sponsor. And a lot of people don't like Ed, but from the standpoint of the unions, he does that part of his work well. That's all he can do, fine. Stay with it.
Yeah.
Everybody needs the kind of... I mean, your stuff, I wish to... I hate to talk about this guy that I don't think exists, but I hope to somebody that people could hear more of your work on although I love the conversation style. That's, you know, I get on with some of these folks, you got to cram everything in real quick to get something across.
Yeah, you wind up feeling like an auctioneer.
Yeah, exactly. I was with some woman on the West Coast last week, they were talking about voting rights and about 30 years ago, I knew a bunch of people who were still talking about, in their mind, only landowners should vote. Now, if I'm not mistaken, that was a constitutional issue.
Yeah, it most assuredly was. And that was the way the Constitution was originally constituted.
Who fought to get that changed?
Well, there was that dust up in 1860.
Oh.
But no, I mean there was the one that the teabaggers and the right wingers really love to harp on now is that they want to go back to when folks didn't get to vote for no senators. When the Senate was properly appointed by the state government the way the framers and founders and Jesus intended them to be.
Yeah, leave Jesus out of it. He wasn't of the convention, was he?
He was there in every spirit and every soul, Bill.
Okay. I know if he came through the airport today, he'd get arrested.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, yeah. You mentioned tips running downhill in a hurry.
Yeah.
Well, you know, turnabout is fair play. And you know who this Russell Pierce character was. He was the lawmaker who was bosom buddies with that Kobach creep from Kansas and was instrumental in ramming through SB 1070 in Arizona.
Which is?
The papers please law.
Oh, that one, yeah.
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 Well, he got booted out of the Senate. He was recalled.
Yeah, okay, now I know you.
I mean, this guy is a fellow traveler with various and sundry skinheads, knuckleheads, right-wingers, Nazis, you know, real Nazis. That not used as a generically critical term. Real, you know, goose-stepping, right.
Yeah, there's a lot of people like that. You remember George Lincoln Rockwell, of course.
Oh, sure, sure. Well, here's a little case of turnabout is fair play. And if you can imagine the gall of doing this, for starters... He wants to get back into the Senate. And so he's got him an election campaign going to get reelected to the Senate, Russell Pierce does. And part of me goes, part of me thinks I'm ashamed of being happy about this. But the other part of me says, you know what? Revenge is a dish that is best served cold.
Yeah.
And so he was trying to find somewhere to have himself a little campaign fundraiser event. You know where this pasty-faced, doughy moron went, Bill?
Mm.
Mexican restaurants.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Good place to eat.
Now, what else did he assault while in office? Public schools. So he also went to a public school library, trying to find somewhere, on the cheap, of course, to have himself a campaign fundraiser. And the two Mexican restaurants and the one school library said, you know what? You might want to be going and campaigning somewhere else.
Good. Good. It's about time that somebody once in a while tells these people the same crap they hand to everybody else.
Well, that was my thought.
And you know, and I won't keep it but another minute, but you know what the school thing is about. It's not just about wages. It's about sneaking Jesus in the back door.
Well, beyond that, it's also about the general desire of a whole lot of white people in this country to eliminate any sort of social safety net, public commons things, if they have the least suspicion that those public commons might be accessed by people not quite as white as they.
They are, yeah.
And there was an overt attempt to destroy public school systems in the immediate aftermath of Brown versus Board of Education.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
With the white flight and the creation of all those Southern academies.
Yep. Yeah, I remember that, too. And as I say, it's a shame because, there are certain country musicians that just hit me hard. Marty Robbins did a thing called Don't Worry About Me back about 1960 with a fuzz tone in it. And that was the first time I'd ever heard that thing being done, you know. And he could sing. That man could sing. Well, you worked for Phillips, and he had a slew of white guys that could sing.
Oh,
and, before
a few
that,
of them.
You know. Yeah, before that he was recording blues, a lot of it, and I won't keep you, but it's just, do your damnedest out there, because this situation, that Maria Gonneau, that situation was enough to There's a hole in my wall about the size of my head, I think. After I heard that story, I said, Jesus God, what is with these people?
Yeah, and so far there's been utterly no remorse manifested by Representative Lamborn or any of the other godless, soulless, motherless Republicans who pulled that filthy stunt.
Yeah. Well, someday we'll have to sit and talk. As I say, I met Dennis when he was about 19, Dennis Kay, and what a guy he was. I mean, he knew this city, and he admired a guy named Tom Johnson, who was mayor here in the early 1900s, who was a millionaire, but didn't act like one. And Dennis really respected this guy's work, and what they tried to do to him to get him recalled was he wouldn't give up our municipal light plant to let the private plant dominate the whole place totally.
Well, remember when he refused to sell off the muni, not only that, but the mob put out a hit on him.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's another side of my life, that my dad's brother worked for the fellas. I remember going to his house in about 49 and 50. I'm a little kid, and there's six slot machines there. My uncle made my dad put money in them before he let me play them. Nice family, you know. I laughed so hard at those two guys. They were good friends.
Yeah, I guess you saw where Henry Hill passed away, right?
Oh, yeah. Somebody was just talking about that. And the story that we were discussing, that was that the guy Hill worked for was not that big a man, was not that big in the group.
Yeah, it was the Lucchese family, wasn't it?
Yeah. And what was his name? Pauly. He had a good-sized crew and such, but he was not, you know.
That far up the food chain?
Yeah. And I remember that thing that happened in Appalachia. Yeah. Well, what do they call up in New York State? When those guys were having a meeting at...
Was it Appalachia, Pennsylvania, or Appalachia, New York?
New York.
Yeah.
And some guy cruising past all these Lincolns and Cadillacs with all these young guys standing out there laughing and joking. And there was a scene where some of these guys were trying to run through the woods. It would have been hilarious watching guys with expensive suits and, you know, Stetson shoes running through muddy woods. Would have been hilarious in itself, you know. But anyway, you go ahead, because I'm sure I hope there's a bunch of people. And thanks for those dates, because, man, that's one thing I ain't gonna miss that. I mean, I had some friends that went to Case, and I used to go down, and Bill Randall used to teach communications, and I'd go down there and check him out because of his, he was somebody I listened to in 55 a lot. He brought Elvis to Cleveland in 55 to a high school. And he came to hear me one time, and that was a thrill, believe me, when you see a guy that had as much knowledge of music as he had, and to see him sitting in an audience in a bar that you... Some of these bars I played in, you look around and you say, man, I wouldn't come in here for a drink. This place looks too rough for me. I'm out of here. Anyway, have the best trip possible.
Well, thank you, Bill. I appreciate it. You have a wonderful weekend, and we'll talk when we get back.
Take care, sir.
All right, and bye now. Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. If you're from around Cleveland, you know the name, Mr. Stress, a bluesman of extraordinary talent. It is about 16 minutes before the hour. No, it isn't. It's about 26 minutes before the hour. Going to have to find the reset button on that clock once the... See, that I don't want to end this 10 minutes early. But I want to do something real quick, a couple of things, because when Bill mentions music as being good music, and Isaac says he's got good taste and sends along a clip, I figure you might very well want to hear that. So this is Trombone Shorty. The track is Due to Me.
Showing up tonight, so to show and prove, I know you feel so good when you're feeling the groove, and I can show you how it's done. But hold on, not
make the fire last. You wanna feel it from me, I wanna feel it from you. I say, what you gonna do?
What you gonna do to me?
What I'm gonna do to you? I bet you like it. You like it? Late night, with the lights down low, safe and sound by the bedroom door. I bet you still want more, I bet you still want more. And then you shake it like a thing at four. Crazy, to be holding out, waiting till no one's around. There's no better place than here. There's no better time than now. What I'm gonna do to you? I bet you like.
Want you to know we're still in the Gulf.
There's fishing in Mississippi.
There's shrimp in Louisiana. You know what sucks about shrimp? Eyes.
Ooh, eyes.
I don't want anything looking at me when I'm eating it.
Now the Gulf features eyeless shrimp.
With 100% less eyes.
Since BP poured oil and dispersant into the water, things just got awesomer.
Ooh, sounds exotic.
Best of all, scientists say it's
probably
completely healthy
and probably
fine to eat. Come to the Gulf and see what BP's been up to.
We're spending big money on ads to remind you.
BP never left.
Now we'd like a f***ing cookie or something.
BP, we're still slathered all over the Gulf, and now we'd like a f***ing cookie or something.
We'll be right back.
Couldn't resist a little interlude there. We had Trombone Shorty as recommended, as mentioned by Bill and recommended by Isaac, and due to me. Wow, that was hot. And then by request, a little something for Jim. Soul Food to Go by the Manhattan Transfer. And between it, a brilliant, utterly brilliant piece of satire by a group calling themselves the Partisans, about the fact that when one orders shrimp, Gulf shrimp, you remember the passage from the sadly named ruination of the wonderful book Forrest Gump, in which Bubba says, we got boiled shrimp, fried shrimp, shrimp etouffee, shrimp burgers, shrimp gumbo. Yeah, that one. Yeah. Well, now all of that comes to you without eyes. Thanks to BP. And I love that line. We're BP. We want a cookie or something. You can, if you want to view the clip, because the video with it is equally good, it's over at Raw Story. Satirist thanks BP for creating eyeless shrimp. Everything's okay. They didn't need it. You know, they crawl around on the bottom of the ocean. So what do you need with eyes? Right? Yeah. Let's, well, not much left of conversation radio for, yeah, a little over a week or so. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome, Jim. It's a wonderful song.
I think it is, too. As a matter of fact, on the same CD is a Nightingale playing in Barclay Square.
Oh, that disc has a lot of classics on it.
Sure does.
Tuxedo Junction, which might be appropriate to my coming journey, is also on that, the very best of the Manhattan Transfer.
Tuxedo Junction, where are you going?
I'm headed to Alabama. A little bit nervously. But you know the lyric to Tuxedo Junction begins, there's a place down in Birmingham.
Birmingham, yes, sure do. Sure do. I've heard that many times.
Yeah.
God, Lord, have that former generation certainly has some wonderful songs.
Oh, yes, they did.
Today. And I appreciate you playing that. And hope you have a good trip down to Alabama Stan or wherever you want to call it.
Well, I wish they wouldn't do things that gave me the inclination to call it that.
Well, unfortunately, that's...
I've never been even the slightest bit nervous about returning to that state. Now I am. I'm wondering if I should take my passport.
Well, we don't have internal passport systems yet, so you don't have to worry about that. That's for sure.
Yeah, but I think I've largely lost my Alabama accent. It's mostly a hillbilly accent now. It might be taken for foreign.
I don't think you have a hillbilly accent, Bob. You know it, and I know it. Any more than I do. But anyway, you know, there's one place in Alabama that I remember where it wasn't so bad. That was Huntsville because of the federal presence there.
Right, and the massive NASA and Redstone Arsenal presence.
Yeah, you got it. Absolutely.
In fact, not turning everything on my recent travels, but my first experience with so-called German food came in Huntsville, because of course when the Second World War ended, we promptly rescued Ferner von Braun and all of his buddies at Peenemünde.
Oh.
And hide them hence.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, it was either that or Stalin would get them. So there it is. And they fathered our modern-day space program.
Yeah.
I mean, von Braun was a rocket enthusiast from his earlier days, but then he got hooked up with... the Nazis, and I think he was even put in jail once. He was jailed because the SS had taken over the rocket program, and, you know, while Von Braun was talking about going to the moon, the current people in charge wanted to develop the bus bomb and the V-2. And he was locked up for that.
I remember, I forget if it was Firesign Theater or whom, but they had a little rhyme one time, and it was quite, well, at the time, quite humorous. The rocket goes up, who cares where it comes down? It's not my concern, says Von F. N. Braun.
Well, that's the way those things were. I mean, they basically pointed them in the right direction toward London, and that was it.
Oddly enough, it did not accomplish its stated goals, however, because the British did not become terrorized and simply knuckle under and sue for peace.
No, they did not. But the terror was there. I know a British lady. She's passed away, but she remembers those buzz bombs coming into London where she lived, and she remembers taking her son, who was a friend of mine, and all she could do was hide under the stairs. And you know, and I don't know how many thousands of people those rockets killed, but nonetheless, those sites were sort of put out of commission once we got ashore in France and began to knock them out. But they still began to fire them, and they would, you know, they developed the first mobile launching system and all that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah,
right. You know,
and consequently, the folks of Huntsville, Alabama, were introduced to such magnificent Bavarian delicacies as Rouladen and Sauerbraten and Spätzle. And nothing has been the same. When I was a little boy, we would stop there. Huntsville was 72 miles to the east, as I noted earlier. And it was a bigger town, considerably. It's freaking huge now.
Oh yeah.
It's just an exercise in sprawl. It has the worst driving in the state of Alabama, I believe. But we would go over there for shopping because they had a mall, Jim. Maybe the first mall in Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And in that mall was a little place called the Old Heidelberg Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
And my father would sit down in there, being quite responsible, and drink a cold German beer. The only place he could get it, because it was legal. It was legal to both have and drink beer in Huntsville, Alabama, because they never would have gotten the Germans to stay had it not been.
Well, I guess not. I mean, that's a good example.
We'll take Stalin. He'll give us beer.
Right.
Right. So, but I grew up in a dry county, and you know what those are. And so my father would sit and drink a cold German beer, and little bitty Bob would get bowls of warm sauerkraut and warm sweet and sour red cabbage, and little plates of Spätzle. And it began a love affair that has yet to end.
Well, I can understand that. I still enjoy that affection. You know, there's another place in Wisconsin near Vogt Field, and I cannot remember the restaurant to save my life, but it was an incredibly good German restaurant because I had to go to Wisconsin because Fort McCoy was there.
Was that the expedition during which you spotted the painted cows?
On Route 5, this farmer had actually painted COWS on his cows, and I stopped, and I just asked him.
Why?
I said, how you doing? He said, where are you from? I said, D.C. And I said, why do you have COWS on your cows? I mean, I was thinking of Rose Nyland and St. Olaf. I said, what's going on? And he said, these crazy idiots come up from Chicago, and I've had several shot. I said, you mean to tell me they don't know the difference between a cow and other types of
ungulates
of playing game? And he said, no. He said, I'm totally serious. I was driving.
Well, and you know, from the cow's perspective, it beats the hell out of having cow branded on them now, doesn't it?
Well, I guess it does. Certainly, it's certainly does, and from whatever happens to them, God knows, I know.
I've got friends in southern West Virginia who have periodically referred to cattle, people who grew up hard, mind you, refer to cattle as slow elk.
Oh, my Lord.
You know.
Slow elk.
Ain't had no meat in a while. We're going to go out and take a slow elk.
Well, I'll tell you, I had some good times in Wisconsin, and, you know, Fort McCoy was a good place to be. I mean, it was just strange, interesting for me when I first went there because the winters were so terribly bad. But I did have the opportunity on the weekend to go down Route 5 to La Crosse, which is a really neat town. And at the airport at La Crosse, there's all this Amelia Earhart.
Oh, wow.
Amelia. Yeah. And I'm not sure, and I never could quite make the connection because when I went to the airport, there was always some blue bus or some car waiting on me, so I never could really ask anybody. But there were all these pictures of her and things like that at the La Crosse airport. Just a little.
I'll be darned. We'll have to investigate that. And by the way, thanks for pointing out that this is Magna Carta Day.
It is. I mean, that was the first step toward relinquishing absolute power.
And, you know, after Richard the First and after Richard the after John the First, I'm sorry, you know, because it was King John who was such a miserable screw-up that the barons rebelled against him. You realize the English have never had another King John to this day.
I've noticed that. And, you know, it's like I say, it's a landmark in history, and it's a tribute to the heritage of many of us. And I just thought of it a few minutes ago about June 15th, 1512, or whenever it was, or 1215.
On the field at Runnymede.
You got it, absolutely.
And I always wondered about that because as an amateur brewer at one point in time, I became quite adept, Jim, at making mead. Because I always wanted to know what it tasted like, because in ninth grade, you know, they made us read Beowulf.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, everything centers around the mead hall at Heorot, not a beer hall, not a wine hall, it's a mead hall. And I wanted to know what it was that could give you enough courage to go and rip the arm off a monster.
Well, you take some honey and mix it with whatever they do, and I'll guarantee you one thing.
It gets righteous.
Yes, sir.
And then in learning my world history and my, you know, the history of what did Winston call it? Winston Churchill call it the history of the Anglo-Saxon speaking peoples. Runny mead, because once I knew what mead was, you know, it pours out. You can either make it sparkling or you can make it still. But I couldn't imagine what runny is. That mead that you've made too thick? Or is that mead where something has gone terribly, terribly wrong?
I don't know whether it's made too thick or made too wrong. If you have enough of that, I'll guarantee you it'll put you in a land where men are men and sheep are nervous.
Yes, indeed, and monsters have one arm.
There you go. Well, listen, have a good trip to Alabamistan.
Yeah, D.C. first, then Alabamistan.
Well, good luck with D.C. I know that's very dear to your heart, and it's dear to the hearts of a lot of people. I hope that something will be done. I hope they'll listen. But anyway, listen,
thank you very kindly, Jim.
You take care, have a good trip, and thanks again for Manhattan Transfer. And like I say, for those other people who would like them, they ought to get the CD and hear a Nightingale sing in Barclay Square. That's a beautiful song.
It is. It is. Originally, Vera Lynn, was it?
Vera Lynn, yeah, your father used to listen to her.
Yes, he did.
Told me that, my father too. And she's just incredible.
Well, take care, Jim. Have a good weekend, and we'll talk soon, I hope.
Okay, take care. God bless.
Bye now. And thus we come to the end of Friday on the Front Porch, what seems entirely too soon. This has been a fun one. It's been a great couple of weeks. I'm sorry to be away. And I'm not trying to inflate my own sense of worth, but this is and has been very special to me and very important to me. And I hate being away, but this is, to my mind, utterly, absolutely, unconditionally necessary. So we will talk soon. And you can always friend up on Facebook or follow me on Twitter. And I'll be tweeting along the way, and I hope you'll join in on that. Thanks for your kind contributions. Four of them this evening got us $260 toward the $300 we needed to raise this evening, and I think that is pretty amazing, and I thank you very, very kindly. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, and thanks most of all to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and stoptheache.org. Go there and learn how you can help end Appalachia's agony. And always, 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 Gina, Judy,